This is AgriPulse Open Mic. I'm your host, Jeff Daly. Our guest this week is Dave Puglia, President and CEO of Western Growers. AgriPulse Open Mic is brought to you by NCIS, the National Crop Insurance Services. Crop insurance, the smartest, most efficient way to secure America's food, fiber, and fuel supply. AgriPulse Open Mic continues with Dave Puglia of Western Growers next. Today's Open Mic segment is brought to you by America's crop insurance industry, which is thankful for the continued support of farmers, commodity organizations, rural businesses, lenders, and lawmakers who are fighting to maintain a strong farm safety net. Providing individualized protection on more than 540 million acres of farmland, crop insurance remains the smartest, most efficient way to secure America's food, fiber, and fuel supply. This is AgriPulse Open Mic. Crop farmers in western states have struggled against heat, wildfires, dwindling water supplies, and the burdensome weight of state and federal regulations. In the case of EPA's new herbicide strategy, Western Growers President and CEO Dave Puglia says they're thankful for the agency's attempt to avoid litigation.
Well, we're still analyzing it. There are some trouble spots, but I will say that the EPA has been, in all of our meetings with them and conversations with them for several years now, they have been acting diligently to try and get ahead of a litigation avalanche that would throw the entire crop protection system into turmoil. And so we didn't come at this collectively, ourselves and US EPA, we didn't come at this in a position of strength given the threatened litigation and the likelihood that it might succeed. So this is going to be a long, painful process, I'm afraid. There's no way around it as long as the Endangered Species Act is constructed the way it is and enforced the way it is. And so I really think it goes more to a discussion about congressional action to better delineate the lines of turf between the Endangered Species Act and FIFRA, for example. But that getting anything passed through Congress these days is pretty difficult. So it's a work in progress, and I think, I will say US EPA has, in my view, been trying very, very diligently to stay ahead of a litigation disaster.
Let's talk about recent rulings by the EPA over pesticide registration, re-registration, and the use impacting specialty crop growers.
We're seeing an increasing trend, and I think it started with chlorpyrifos in California having its registration withdrawn without any true process or science process behind it. Just a quick arbitrary decision, snap decision to withdraw the registration of that active ingredient in California, and the U.S. EPA followed suit not long thereafter. And I think we're starting to see that sort of mode of decision-making take hold within U.S. EPA, and it's deeply concerning. We have a already reduced toolbox of crop protection tools in the synthetic side of things. At the same time, we're seeing increased pest and disease pressures in places that hadn't experienced them before due to a warming climate in certain regions. And so, the obvious dilemma here is that as you see increasing pest and disease pressure and you're reducing the tools in the toolbox to deal with them, you're left with nothing. So one of the reasons that we've put so much time and attention and money into trying to fast-track the development and approval of biological tools that can be efficacious and economically feasible in our industry, because we recognize as much as we will fight to protect the synthetic tools that we have and that we need to continue to have, we're going to have some next generation tools from the biological space coming to the market as quickly as possible in the event that we can't protect synthetic tools in the regulatory arena, and that is looking more and more dire to me.
So how do you meet the demand of the consumer that wants an organic product and one that doesn't mind conventional production, because you represent both?
The beauty of the free market, and it's the adaptability and innovation of the members of Western Growers who can respond to those consumer signals, consumer demands very quickly. It's the reason that we have a fast-growing organic segment in our membership and still a very large conventional segment of our membership, because that's what consumers want. They want both. And So we have a very robust industry in terms of meeting that demand. I get concerned when government policymakers want to impose their own deadlines or waymarkers for organic production. For instance, in California, there is a articulated policy that we want to have, I think it's 40% of all food produced in California produced organically by 2040. Well, that may or may not happen based on market demand, but if it isn't demanded by consumers at that level of production, then you're forcing production into a market that doesn't exist. And we know how that turns out. That's the sort of command and control of an economy that wrecks private enterprise and leaves consumers unhappy as choices go away and prices go up. So it really is the magic of the free market at work when we talk about the growth of organic, and we're happy to oblige. What consumers tell us they want, we'll provide it.
Does the Department of Agriculture have clear definitions for what is conventional and what is organic?
I think the definition is quite clear when it comes to organic versus conventional. There is much more uncertainty and gray area around other non-legally based definitions. Organic, of course, is based in the federal code as a definition, but when you talk about sustainably produced or locally sourced, those are the kinds of terms that are applied to products without any definitional rigor. And so consumers kind of have to be aware of that and be cautious of that. You know, I've seen stores that have quote-unquote local produce, an item or two that they say is local, and knowing a little bit more than the average Joe, I'll ask the produce manager, just how local is this, because I know it didn't come from my area, and then I find out it came from 500 miles away. So that's okay. I mean, we have a wonderful adaptive industry that can produce great quality products, fruits and vegetables and tree nuts, and get that product across the country or even around the world and maintain freshness and flavor. So, you know, I'm all for it. But I do think that there is a lot of, we'll call it flexibility in the aisle when consumers are looking at things that, again, look like they're labeled as sustainably produced or locally produced.
Davis, I have the opportunity to host this show, Open Mic. I get to talk to all kinds of different agriculture leaders across the country and of different commodities, and labor is mentioned as a top issue for nearly all. Are you also finding it a challenge to find adequate workforce?
We find it, we're finding it to be an existential challenge. We have been pounding this table for over a decade. We've been at the forefront of legislation that has been negotiated, crafted, and passed by the Senate in 2013 on a bipartisan basis, and then by the House on a bipartisan basis in 2019 and 2020, 2 years in a row, only to see those efforts blocked when the other House, the other chamber, didn't take them up. We keep going at this because we have an aging workforce. We in the fresh produce industry are especially labor-intensive for most of our crops. So we have a workforce that's aging out. They're not being replaced by immigrants coming from our southern border. Although many people are coming across our southern border, they don't appear to be coming to work on our farms. And so we have a very serious labor crisis. It's getting worse. It's forcing growers in the West to increasingly turn to the H-2A lifeboat for lack of any other option to secure labor. And that has become increasingly unsustainable for growers who are mid-sized or certainly on the smaller side. In California, for example, the adverse effect wage rate, which is the dictated wage for H-2A workers, has gone up in California 34% from the 2020 rate. So just since 2020, a one-third increase in that wage rate, compounded by, of course, having to pay transportation and housing costs for those workers, that's not sustainable. And it forces growers to make some really hard decisions about whether to stay in the business, whether to give the farm up to a private equity group, which we're seeing more and more of in the Western U.S., which I am a little troubled by as we lose multi-generational family farmers, or to invest south of our border, produce the same products at a much lower cost than can be done in the West. So it is a very serious problem. We are driving very hard to try and increase the investment in automation technologies that can pick up the slack where we don't have adequate labor. But automated harvesting of most fresh produce items is a very tough thing to do. It of course, depends on what we're talking about, but if you're talking about, for example, strawberries or peaches, you know, very delicate items that can't be handled roughly by robots and by machines. So we still need those manual labor expertise. So, it's a very, very serious challenge. And I'm afraid that we're not really taking it that seriously in this country. We have this expectation that our food supply will always be secure, that our fresh produce will always be wonderful, fresh, and delicious. And we have a bit of a dilemma in the fact that we meet that need. We meet that expectation, but we're increasingly doing it by looking south of the border or to other continents like South America to supply our fresh produce. And I don't think that ultimately is a positive for this country.
Well, there's a tremendous affinity for the small, the medium-sized farm and the family farm. And the fact that there is labor, am I fair to assume that if the robotics or the automation is available, that it's very expensive and very challenging then for the small and the medium-sized operation to be able to afford? So the lack of labor is pushing operations to be larger.
That's exactly right. That is exactly right. I've had growers who are mid-size in California, which in context is still a pretty large operation if you look at national production. But I've had those growers tell me, look, I'm glad you all are pursuing automation. You need to do it. It's the right thing to do, but it probably won't be affordable for me. And so my decision is probably going to be the same in the coming years, one way or another. I'm going to have to find a partner. I'm going to have to give up the farm, sell out to a larger operation, hopefully to another multi-generational family farm company, but it may be to private equity. I think that's true. Now, we also think that if we can keep this process of technology innovation and automation moving quickly, we'll be able to bring more of those types of solutions to market more quickly. That should eventually, hopefully and without too much time, lower the cost for growers to be able to utilize that technology, probably as a service model rather than as a purchase model. But there are a lot of ifs in what I just said, and I don't think we have the time to sit on our hands. I think that we're getting close to a moment where most mid-sized and certainly smaller growers are going to run out of time if we can't intervene quickly.
Dave, staying with the discussion of labor, how is the lack of labor affecting the amount of land in production, the crops that are being produced, or the overall production from these operations in the U.S.? Can you measure the impact in any of these categories?
It's hard to measure, largely because these are all private companies. They don't like to share a lot of proprietary information, and they consider a lot of this proprietary. But we know anecdotally from many of them in private conversations that they will reduce their expansion plans for California or go to zero expansion and maintain their current levels of production, but expand or initiate new production south of the U.S. border in Mexico or South America. So it's hard to capture from a statistical standpoint, but I think certainly anecdotally or experientially, as you walk through the produce aisle and you see more and more produce from other countries, we know it's happening. I'd like to be able to capture it in a more statistically relevant way, but it's tough to do.
The discussion about labor then leads us to other topics as the minimum wage, and there is a debate over that now, and also new heat standards that have been put in for workers. Does this also have an impact on your growers?
They do. As cost inputs, of course, they will just exacerbate the existing delta between production cost of any particular item in California versus that same item in Mexico or elsewhere. But I think it's also sort of a question of the cumulative effect of government policies over the last, call it 20, 30 years, that have layered additional costs on producers of goods. Certainly in the produce industry, that's true. And so while any one standalone proposal, for example, outdoor heat illness protection, which we advanced in California in 2005 and 2006, first in the country to do it. Did it cost additional money? Yes. Was it the right thing to do? Yes. I mean, we know it has saved lives of farm workers by putting some relatively simple, although not without cost, standards in place that protect workers to a greater degree when they're working outdoors in the heat. And so any given policy might be defensible as a standalone proposition. It's more important, I think, to look at the universe of regulatory mandates and costs that they collectively place on the backs of growers in the United States and realize that that same burden has not been placed on their competitors in other countries. And so the degree that we keep adding to that burden of regulatory cost, we're not necessarily accomplishing the good that we think regulations will accomplish. What we're accomplishing is the movement of that production to places that don't have anywhere near those protections on the environment or on workers or on quality. And so I think it's a larger discussion about whether we've gone so far in our regulatory scheme to protect all kinds of things that should be protected that we've lost the mission. We've actually ended up incentivizing production in places that will not have those protections in place. And so it gets into a bit of a college economics lecture kind of an atmosphere, but unfortunately it's not theoretical. It's real. It's happening.
Dave, California is leading in transitioning away from liquid fuel powered vehicles, from trucks to forklifts and even locomotives. Will this impact you, and how soon?
It's a great question, and I'll say great in air quotes because it's not a fun discussion. Yes, those policies will impact us dramatically. For example, the Advanced Clean Fleet Rule of the California Air Resources Board, which would phase out heavy-duty trucks that are not powered by electricity. So semi-trucks are going to have to convert to battery power entirely in a short span of time. We don't have in California the infrastructure to be able to charge those trucks where they are out in rural areas. We don't even have the power generation reliability needed to be able to do that. The economics don't work. You're talking about operations that would have to double or more than double their existing fleets because the trucks don't recharge quickly. So you're taking a truck out of service for a fairly long period of time to recharge, and you're talking about perishable products. Fresh produce can't sit around and wait 8 hours or 5 hours for the truck to recharge. So the capital costs of expanding fleets for vehicles, trucks that hardly exist today, that are very, very expensive, to be charged by a network of facilities that don't exist, and the economics around building that out look nasty, and an unreliable power supply grid in California, put all that together and you're talking about an economic calamity that will not be confined to California. If that policy is allowed to go into effect as proposed, it will cause a supply chain disaster in this country in a very short period of time, given the sheer volume of goods that move in and out of California, remembering that we have the ports of Los Angeles, Long Beach, and Oakland, which are huge import-export ports for this country, and, of course, all the fresh produce that comes out of California. So potentially disastrous. I'm still hoping, waiting that for leaders in Sacramento, starting with the governor, to realize this is a policy that does not have any basis in reality. And while it sounds good that we want to electrify our heavy-duty truck fleets, we don't exist on an island, and we don't have the infrastructure or the money to build that infrastructure available right now. And I don't see it coming anytime soon. So, yeah, we're highly concerned about that, and we've been increasingly loud about it.
Dave, we are still shy in Washington of having a new farm bill, and this is a deep topic for nearly every commodity organization that's included. But what are the pieces of a new farm bill that should be amended to work better for a safety standpoint, from a marketing standpoint, from a risk management standpoint for specialty growers?
The Specialty Crop Farm Bill Alliance has 109 proposals on the table. Many of them were incorporated one way or another in the bill passed by the House Ag Committee. So we're pretty pleased with that work product. It isn't perfect. There are pieces that we're missing, but all in all, a pretty darn good bill for the specialty crop industry. Given that we in specialty crops are 50% of farm gate value in this country and less than 10% of the farm bill's resources, we think that it doesn't take much for this next farm bill to be transformative for us. We're not a big part of the farm bill, but a significant increase in investment in specialty crop programs may not mean very much to the overall cost of the farm bill, but it would be transformative for us. So some of those things go to items like mechanization, where we've proposed new funding to increase the speed of research into mechanization and automation in specialty crop industry, increased funding for specialty crop research initiative, for the market access program for specialty crop block grants, and then you mentioned risk management. That's a big one. We've never had a real viable crop insurance program for most of the commodities that are grown in the specialty crop industry. Some of them do use crop insurance fairly effectively, especially some permanent crops, but trees and vines. But most of our crops don't have access to viable crop insurance products. And we've had some really good movement and agreement with the Four Corners on expanding the reach of crop insurance to cover all risks for crops that are not tree crops, vine crops. And so that looks very, very important to us and promising to us. There's a long way to go to kind of build that model out.
Dave, if Congress is not able to accomplish a new farm bill in this calendar year, will an extension of the 18 meet the needs of Western growers one more time?
I don't think it would really meet the needs of our members. We've had so much change in the specialty crop industry in this country since 2018, much of it having to do with the exacerbated labor shortage problem, the need for greater research around pest and disease, the need for greater risk protection as we have increased threats to our annual production of any number of crops. So, no, I don't think so. I think extension is an easy concept to understand, but it simply puts us 1 year further down the line of having far less support than specialty crop industry should be getting from the farm bill. Again, with 50% of the farm gate value and only 10%, less than 10% of farm bill resources, we really shouldn't extend that imbalance for another year.
Well, Dave Puglio, we want to thank you very much for taking time to be with us on this edition of Open Mic. Certainly a tremendous amount of issues are in front of our Western growers, but we appreciate what you and what they do and what they provide for the nutritional and food needs of the nation. Thanks for being here. This is Open Mic, and today you have the final word.
Thanks, Jeff. Always appreciate the opportunity to speak with you and to be on Open Mic. You're right. We're beset by a lot of issues in the West. We're holding up pretty well, but I do hope that this next 4 years, there'll be a new administration, and I do hope that there's increased attention to the trend of increasing production of our food supply abroad and doing what we can do and need to do to bring it back to the U.S.
Our thanks to Dave Puglia, President and CEO of Western Growers, our guest this week on Open Mic. AgriPulse Open Mic is brought to you by NCIS, the National Crop Insurance Services. Crop insurance, the smartest, most efficient way to secure America's food, fiber, and fuel supply. For AgriPulse, I'm Jeff Nally.